Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. So is Dr. Ben Carson, from his fixation with ancestral grains to nutritional supplements, is he running to be the next president or the next Dr. Oz?
The wonderful thing about a company like Manitech is that they recognize that when God made us, he gave us the right fuel. And that fuel was the right kind of healthy food. A lot of people are surprised they go out and they see a dog that's sick eating grass. Why is that dog eating grass? He should be eating meat. No, because the dog recognizes that natural green produce has the things in it that will make him feel better. Now, if a dog can come to that understanding, we with our sophisticated brains ought to know that there's an awful lot of really good stuff in natural products.
Actually, bacon and hot dogs do the same thing for me. So Ben Carson isn't the only Republican who uses and pushes nutritional supplements. Joining us online for his take on this and other medical headlines is Art Kaplan. Art, as you know, is head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He's also the co-host of the Everyday Ethics podcast. Hello there, Art.
Hello. I got to say to Ben, dogs also eat their own poop.
Yeah.
Thank you for that, Art.
Well, as long as you mention that, Art Kaplan, having owned dogs in my life, one of the reasons dogs eat grass is to make themselves sick when they don't feel good. So
yep.
That they will regurgitate what feels bad in their tummy. That
exactly.
That's not why they eat grass, because it's
exactly.
Nutritional value. Oh,
we should have gotten a vet other than Art Kaplan today. Go ahead.
Ben has a better knowledge of the brain than he does perhaps other parts.
Yeah, let's hope so. But you know, many stories have been written. The Washington Post has got one about that liberals get scammed by lots of other things, but conservatives tend to get scammed by these sort of pitches, which is why this may not even hurt Ben Carson.
But you should explain why, because it's an anti-establishment,
yes.
non-traditional medicine thing.
The AMA is plotting against us, and the government is plotting against us, and all these people are plotting against us, and here's the real truth from a guy like Ben Carson about what can really help you.
Buy some gold, too.
Exactly. I'm giving you the straight story. So what's that about?
Well, I think there is a lot of distrust of authorities, of experts. We've always had in the United States, it's just in a sort of waxing period, a kind of anti-intellectual, I don't like the experts, I know best, I know what to do streak. And I think there's been a fair amount of suspicion that the authorities and the experts are under the sway of the left-wing, pinko-secular, progressive conspiracy. So I think those who believe in their own ability to take care of themselves are going to hoard some gold and build a bomb shelter and put pure products in it, and that will get them to the rapture.
Well, yeah, and one of these things that they were advertising, some Alzheimer's reversing drug, the ad talked about Obama's deadly FDA that was preventing people from getting this miracle Alzheimer's drug. But like you say, people do buy it.
They do, and there's a fair amount of sad history around our obsession with the nutritional store. Look, it's not just people who are living off the grid. There's plenty of people who are fairly well-educated, living in Marin County or maybe Wellesley, who are buying the natural products, going to the GNC, trying to pursue, let's call it, natural healing and the paleo diet is not a plot of the right wing.
Yeah, and the vaccine people, a lot of them are in affluent communities.
Well, even locally,
well.
Scott Brown, my buddy in New Hampshire now, wasn't he peddling this weight loss
yes,
thing
he
a
was.
Couple of
yeah,
months ago?
Yeah. Jim has a history.
So it is all over the sort of right-wing radio. You listen to the ads on a Rush Limbaugh or Mark Levin show, but you get it on the left. When people are sort of, I don't trust the artificial, I don't trust industry, I don't trust business, I'm going to try and sort of get pure in my life. So both strains are out there.
Well, you know, let me just say, I don't want to make an editorial comment, but I will. I'm disgusted by this. Money should be sent to Nigerian princes instead, rather than wasting your money. That's where I send my dough. Hey, Art, can we talk about a bunch of kids-related things? There is this study that, at least to me, borders on the ridiculous, and hopefully you'll disabuse me of this. It's in JAMA, Journal of American Medical Association Pediatrics, saying that if parents have a sex talk, even if it is thoroughly ineffective, if they have a sex talk with their kids are more likely to use safe sex, condoms, birth control, etc. So even if you don't do a good job, like I've told Marjorie the story, my father once, when I was a little kid, walked into my room, literally threw a book at me about the proverbial birds and bees, and then ran out as fast as he can. So was that helpful to my development?
No, but it could help the parents. They may learn something.
No, I'm serious. Do you buy this notion here?
I don't know. I mean, it does seem to me that your parents showing some interest in that aspect of your life is positive, even if they're nervous and don't do a very good job about talking, at least opens the door to future conversations. You're not wondering whether you can go there with mom or dad. So, yeah, I don't know. Where's William Proxmire? Are we still spending money on these studies?
Oh, yeah. What did he have, the Golden Fleece Awards?
He was a senator from Wisconsin. Yeah. You know, my favorite thing about these, and it's not in this story, Art, you've seen all the surveys where they ask parents and then the kids of those parents if the parents ever talk to the kids about sex.
Yeah.
And the parents, 90% say, yes, we had a great discussion. And 90% of the kids say, no, we never had this discussion. So in any case.
Well, anyway, who wants to remember a sex discussion with your parents?
Yes, it's horrifying. It's horrifying. Here's another one from the New York Times, Owen. I didn't know what to make of this, which is why I'm so glad I'm talking to you, Art Kaplan, our medical ethicist. They're talking about kids under 5 left to their mobile devices on their own. Some kids as young as, you know, 1 year old are we using a mobile device on a daily basis to play games or watch videos or use apps, which is pretty impressive. They're only a year old. But the study was pointing out that many people think this is a big problem, although at the end they quote some experts saying, well, maybe it's not such a big problem. This is just technology marching on. So is this horrible or not, or don't we know, or what's this, what do you think?
It's the future. Can't go back.
Yeah.
It's the demon rock and roll. The people who don't like it are the people who are over, 25?
Yeah.
Parents, I believe you call them. And, you know, it used to be that we handed our kid or plunked our kid in front of the TV.
Exactly.
And the babysitter.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Now we have this thing.
Right.
There's nothing, zero, nothing you're going to do about it. I mean, you could try to restrict your kids' computer access and do all those sorts of things, and a few people will, but it's still easier when your child is acting up to hand them that little computer screen and give them a game than it is to actually sit there and divert them and play a board game or take them for a walk. I'm not applauding the amount of time spent in front of screens, but I don't think there's much you're going to do about it.
Well, the one thing I did think, you know, there's been studies about older teenagers and young adults who are like, you know, texting nonstop and checking their emails nonstop and all that sort of thing, that says we can't concentrate as well as we used to because we have these constant interruptions all the time. That was one thing I thought, well, if you're starting with these constant back and forth between videos and all that when you're, you know, in diapers, maybe your brain is going to be...
Oh, yeah, I think that's true. I'll give a little personal anecdote. As someone who pops up on TV once in a while, people ask me, well, what's it like to have that 30-second soundbite? 30-second soundbite?
Yeah.
I've been a 30-second soundbite since the Wright brothers. Soundbites are 4 seconds, 3 seconds. You might get on there and say something like, that's wrong. Thank you. Thank you, expert. So you can see attention span shifting all over the place. My students have it. When we present visual material to them, it's got to be snappy. We're going to lose their attention. Yep. Different cognitive style. Is it worse? I don't know. Pretty soon when we're not there or we're not around, I don't think people will think it's worse. They'll just think that's what it is. And then their kids will come up with something to torture them.
Well, but the good news is, even if it turns out this is a bad thing for kids, when they grow a little older, you can send them to one of those internet addiction camps.
Absolutely.
Now, I read this story in the Atlantic.
And they can eat Manitech. Well, sure, and wholesome.
First of all, is internet addiction, and there is a story in The Atlantic. People should read it. It's a pretty good story, actually.
The Atlantic website is great.
Yeah,
I love it. Yeah.
Atlantic.com. Yes. TheAtlantic.com. Is internet addiction a real thing, or what's the deal?
Well, I mean, I think you can get lost there. That certainly you hear people saying, for example, they can't stop watching internet pornography, and I believe that there are people who go into treatment for it. They really just get completely addicted, can do nothing else. Yeah, I think it's a potential addiction. You can become addicted to television. People get addicted to lots of things. It just means that you get so much pleasure and so much good feeling and so much safe feeling kind of from a particular stimulus that you can just get attached to it and forget everything else. So, yeah, I believe it is. Mm-hmm.
Do people like you worry that with the proliferation of screens of every size, every availability, I mean, we are getting to a point where essentially our whole lives, and you know, education reformers talk about how, well, one of the ways we're going to deal with college cost is having courses mm-hmm. available mm-hmm. online mm-hmm. and all that sort of, I mean, ultimately, every part of our life is going to be on a screen, is it not? I mean, is that the end of Western civilization as we know it?
Well, I think it's going to be a lot on the screen, and then it's going to get even better because it's going to become 3D virtual reality type mm-hmm. stuff. That's the future. It's sort of not just, you know, we're going to have Smell-O-Rama. Remember that?
I actually went to a movie that was Smell-O-Rama decades ago.
So they're going to pump scents in, and you'll have some notion of touch and feel there. You didn't ask me what we did on Everyday Ethics this week, but
I will.
We actually did sex robots. I mean, I think they're going to be there. I think you're going to have a partner who's, if you want, you could have an artificial sex partner who would be preferable to your regular partner because they'll do better and perhaps do things that your regular partner doesn't like or whatever. So, yeah, I think we're headed to a kind of screen-driven virtual reality robotic tomorrow. We can worry about that and fret about that. The good news is we won't be there, so it doesn't matter what our fretting is. The bad news is, if you came back as some of our friends who want to freeze their heads and stuff cryonically, I think they'd be completely out of it. They wouldn't know what was going on.
You know,
the future,
I
will pronounce this. Here's my wisdom of
what?
The day. The future will be different.
Wow, that is really deep. We're talking Art Kaplan. Hey, Art, you just tried to gloss over the sex
robot. Yeah.
Do you see the movie Her? Was it Her? Was that what it was called?
Uh-huh. He's in love with his computer.
Yeah. I mean, is that what you're talking about, that kind of thing?
Yeah.
That's Joaquin Phoenix and what's her name? Johansson was the operating system. Or what's her first name?
Well, yeah, but think of a sex
Scarlett Johansson.
Scarlett Johansson,
we do have sex toys now, right?
Yeah.
So think of a sex doll, a robot that's really human-like, and sort of people say, well, I'm single or I'm in prison or I'm
I might want
somebody to come visit me.
Hold on. Forget single and in prison. I think this could take a lot of pressure off a lot of marriages, Art. You know what I'm saying? I mean, all these over 40 guys with their Viagra, you know, they're all revved up and ready to go, and their wives are thinking, you know, I've done enough for my country by now. You know, you go with your sex toy and leave me alone. Yeah. This could be a good thing.
I do, and it also could. People might say, well, you know, I like a little variety, but instead of having every politician arrested for having an affair, now you can just have your little toy.
There you go.
Oh, my
God. There's the future, Jim. You're going to miss it, though.
Let's move on.
Yeah.
You know, Art Kaplan, one last kid thing. There was a story in the Boston Globe yesterday. There was a poll out of the School of Public Health at Harvard. And now we're supposed to call it the Chan School of Public Health, thanks to a third of $1 billion contribution, saying, not surprisingly, but I thought this was a good thing, that 65% of us consider e-cigarettes to be harmful. So a bunch of questions. One, for starters, does that poll and that sort of public sentiment make it more likely that the FDA actually decides to regulate these things? Where is that? What's the status of that?
Yeah, I'm sorry, Jim. I can't answer that. I'm trying to look up Mr. Chan to see if he might donate to NYU here.
He owns Harvard Square, too, I should say. He does.
I don't think he'll be donating to NYU. Yeah. He's pretty enamored of Harvard. So I think FDA is watching e-cigarettes, and they see nicotine, and e-cigarettes, the defenders say, are better because they don't have all the other tobacco products and combustion things and tars and all that sort of stuff. So better to use them to get people off of cigarettes or maybe as a substitute for cigarettes. But FDA says addiction to nicotine, that can't be good. It's bad for your heart. It's bad for other things. We're still going to regulate them as, if you will, a health problem. So I think there's a real fight there. And the data's out about whether people get off of real cigarettes by vaping or using e-cigarettes. It's not clear yet.
Well, but there's a story in the I think it was the Washington Post saying that coming out of the Yale School of Public Health, which is not named after Mr. Chan, something about how bans or, I guess, deep regulation of e-cigarettes, let's say a ban on e-cigarettes for teens, may actually increase teens smoking. What's the thinking there? If it's banned,
if it's illegal, I want it.
Well, but cigarettes are illegal.
Love that.
So the theory is that it may drive them even more to the real thing than they would be driven by the illegality of the cigarette for a teen anyway. Is that the theory?
That's the theory. So, in fact, if you really want to restrict the use of any of these things, you've got to make them uncool in the media. That was one of the big things that happened with smoking.
Yeah.
It became uncool and then disappeared from films and TV and that sort of stuff. Athletes can't be seen vaping or using this kind of stuff. Big role models, celebrities, they can't do it or they have to condemn it. And then you kind of restrict where you can do it. You know, what we've been doing with smoking is basically saying, well, you can smoke. There is a small space in Antarctica, and here's a ticket. You can go there, and we'll see you after the lunch break. I mean, it's kind of, you know, there's no place to go.
What's your line about cigarette smokers,
Marjorie?
Oh,
that cigarette smokers have become like the new pedophiles. I mean, if you're smoking, you've got to get 120 feet from the front door. You've got to stand in the middle of the road, basically wait for someone to run you over.
You know, before we leave this topic, though, I've said this to you before. Marjorie's heard me say it 1,000 times. For those who haven't lived long enough to know the power of cigarette advertising, I'll never forget the front page story in the Boston Globe. I'm sure it was all over the country, but I read it in the Boston Globe, that maybe 10 years ago there was a survey of little kids, single-digit kids, and more kids could recognize Joe Camel, who was the face of Camel cigarettes, than could recognize Mickey Mouse. That said everything. So,
and advertising like that, whether it's the Marlboro Man, I still remember all those ads that used to run during football games.
Sure.
Right? I mean, it just I remember them more than they do the football game. So, yeah, very powerful, very slick.
We're talking to our medical ethicist, Art Kaplan. Art, we just learned that the University of Colorado School of Medicine
That's the University of Colorado Chan School of Medicine. No, it's not, but go ahead.
Okay. They announced on Friday they were giving back $1 million they got from Coca-Cola after there were reports that the money had been used to establish this advocacy group that played down the link between soft drinks like Coke and the obesity epidemic. It seems we're talking to you about this a lot. I think we just talked about this kind of thing involving the American Academy, of Pediatrics. So is this an epidemic too, with these supposedly legitimate places getting money to spin their research?
Well, I think there's a long tradition of different groups trying to get their message heard and using academics as one part of that strategy. So whether it's, climate science, which has been back and forth on this 1,000 times, or air pollution kind of stuff, diet, the American Dietetic Association, the dietitians have always had partnerships with some of the big food purveyors, some of the fast food places. That people argue that the food chain is the food pyramid, Ben Carson on my mind, the food pyramid, which is full of grains, but it should be full of perhaps more healthier things, but maybe the industry is undercutting it. So we live in a world where we have to manage those relationships. I think the Colorado School did the right thing in terms of saying you're not transparent, you're not open. What I'm looking for is disclosure, saying, yep, we're funded by Exxon and we think you should drink gasoline 3 times a day. That's our conclusion. I don't know that you're ever going to get rid of the influence of big players on science. It's just there. It just exists.
But, you know, the $1 million is pretty egregious, and Marjorie's right. We talked about this with you on a number of occasions when entities have had to disgorge their money from Coca-Cola once it was discovered. In the same article that Marjorie is reading, it says that since 2010, in the last 5 years, Coke has given $120 million to entities like this perpetuate the notion that as long as you exercise, you can drink sugary things.
And one of them was also the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, the country's largest group of dietitians.
Right. That's what I meant when I said there's a lot of those tendrils that are reaching through to people who make up the food pyramid, who advise us on what we should eat, dietetically, I guess the word is. Yep. So if you're not transparent and you're not disclosing, then I think you ought to do what Colorado did and cut the ties. Question is, you know, if you are open about it and you say, we're sponsoring this study to prove the effectiveness of X, should we prohibit that? And I'll tell you what's been going on. More and more of the companies have been arguing, you can't restrict us. It's free speech. It's related to our friend, the corporation as person, and Citizens United. The companies want to be able to talk. And so that's all of a piece.
All right, Kaplan, since you already told us about your podcast on the sex robots, we can ask you, we have time to ask you one.
Oh, we're going to ask him again at the end.
Just we are. Yes. Well, it's such a great one. That's right. We may as well, why not? Do it twice or three times. But before that, everybody knows you can't buy organs, you can't buy hearts, you can't buy kidneys. But apparently the rich are able to get one, get some, it helps to be rich if you want to get one faster. Why is that?
This is something I've been complaining about forever because I helped design that transplant system and I think it works pretty well. But if organs are distributed regionally, so if I needed an organ and I was in Boston, I'd get organs from around New England, roughly speaking. In New York, I'm going to get them from around the New York area. San Francisco, I'm going to get them from around Northern California. It's partly because you don't want to ship organs great distances. But if you're rich, you can go to Boston, New York, San Francisco, and Memphis and sign yourself up to get an organ. And if you have a jet, then you can get there if one becomes available that matches you. So think of it like a giant roulette wheel. You can put more money down on the numbers and you increase your odds. And that's what the rich have been doing. The system should only allow you to be listed at one place, but if you're rich, you can go to many. And that's why they get the advantage. By the way, that's how Steve Jobs got his liver transplant. If you remember, he got it in Tennessee, which I doubt he lived in.
No, he lived in California.
So is there any chances the guy who used to set up the thing, meaning you, that kind of change will be made, or there's going to be too much resistance?
So there's tons of resistance from the rich. It gets lobbied down. Transplant centers like it because the rich tend to pay full freight. And there's one other problem. It's hard for somebody to say to somebody, you can't go to a doctor of your choice.
I know.
That's the real moral problem. So, you know, if I want to go to the Mayo Clinic to get a physical, no one stops me, even though I could probably get a physical, you know, locally before I go out there. So people say, well, I have a right to go to the doctor that I want. But I think the system should ban this. It's just wrong.
So let me sum up something, if I can, here, Art Kaplan. So you were the guy, one of the people who designed the whole transplant system. That's one. We read the front page of the New York Times a few months ago. You're the guy leading the charge on that Johnson & Johnson thing. 2 days ago when Marjorie was on vacation, you told us that you were the lead person on the whole blood supply thing. So should we assume that you will lead the charge on sex robots next? Is that your next horizon or what?
Come over here, honey.
Exactly.
Oh, sorry.
That is horrible.
Don't knock him.
She's a little rusted there. I can't.
Ouch. Art is great.
Can't
to
quite move her over here.
Great to talk to you.
Could be the future. Could be the future, Jim. Don't you remember the Woody Allen movie when he had the
future will be different.
Yeah.
The future will be different.
I heard that from somebody earlier today.
Thank you, Art.
And great talk to you, Art.
Have a fun day with your friend there. Art Kaplan joins us every week. He is head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He's also the co-host of the Everyday Ethics podcast on sex robots this time. Art Kaplan, it's great to talk to you.